Welcome to Reading Together, an EFM initiative co-funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland's Sound Division Fund. Dublin City Council's award-winning initiative led by Dublin City Libraries designated Dubliners as their 2012 Book of the Year. To close this year, EFM wants to join in the celebrations by organising a series of public readings where Joyce's Dubliners will be read in public places to reach a wider audience. Our series started with the last story of the book and probably the best known, The Dead. We rejoined the reading in the second part of our series at Ms. Markham's annual dance, where the guests are enjoying music and dancing and a few drinks. Freddie and Mr. Brown are there, and also Gabriel Conroy, the Morgan's nephew, who is coming to the end of his speech after a delightful dinner.
All the guests stood up, glass in hand, and turning towards the three seated ladies, sang in unison with Mr. Brown as leader. For they are jolly good fellows, or they are jolly gay fellows, they are jolly gay fellows, which nobody can deny. Auntie Kate was making frank use of her handkerchief, and even Aunt Julia seemed moved. Freddie Mallins beat time with his pudding fork, and the singers turned towards one another as if in melodious conference, while they sang with emphasis, until she tells a lie, unless he tells a lie. Then turning once more towards the hostesses, they sang, for they are jolly gay fellows, for they are jolly gay fellows, for they are jolly gay fellows, which nobody can deny. The acclamation which followed was taken up beyond the door of the supper room by many of the other guests and renewed time after time. Freddie Mallins acting as officer with fork held high. The piercing morning air came into the hall where they were standing, so Aunt Kate said, close the door, somebody. Mrs. Mallins will get her death of cold. Brown is out there, Aunt Kate, said Mary Jane. Brown is everywhere, said Aunt Kate, lowering her voice. Mary Jane laughed at her tone. Really, she said archly, he is very attentive. He's been laid on here like the gas, said Aunt Kate, in the same tone, all during the Christmas. She laughed herself this time good-humouredly, and then added quickly, but tell him to come in, Mary Jane, and close the door. I hope to goodness he didn't hear me. At that moment, the hall door was opened and Mr. Brown came in from the doorstep, laughing as if his heart would break. He was dressed in a long green overcoat with mock astrakhan cuffs and collar and wore on his head an oval fur cap. He pointed down at the snow-covered quay from where the sound of shrill, prolonged whistling was borne in. Teddy will have all the cabs in Dublin out, he said. Gabriel advanced from the little party behind the office, struggling into the overcoat and looking round the hall, said, Greta, not down yet. She's getting her things, Gabriel, said Aunt Kate. Who's playing up there, asked Gabriel. Nobody, they're all gone. Oh, no, Aunt Kate said. Mary Jane, Bartle Darcy and Miss O'Callaghan aren't gone yet. Someone is strumming at the piano, anyhow, said Gabriel. Mary Jane glanced at Gabriel and Mr. Brown and said with a shiver, it makes me feel cold to look at you two gentlemen muffled up like that. I wouldn't like to face your journey home at this hour.
I'd like nothing better this minute, said Mr. Brown stoutly, than a rattling fine walk in the country or a fast drive with a good spanking gore between the shafts. We used to have a very good horse and trap at home, said Aunt Julia sadly. The never-to-be-forgotten Johnny, said Mary Jane laughing. Aunt Kate and Gabriel laughed too. Why, what was wonderful about Johnny? Asked Mr. Brown. The late lamented Patrick Morcan, our grandfather that is, explained Gabriel, commonly known in his later years as the old gentleman, was a glue boiler. Oh now, Gabriel, said Aunt Kate laughing, he had a starch mill. Well, glue or starch, said Gabriel, the old gentleman had a horse by the name of Johnny. And Johnny used to work in the old gentleman's mill, walking round and round in order to drive the mill. That was all very well, but now comes the tragic part about Johnny. One fine day, the old gentleman thought he'd like to drive out with equality to a military review in the park. The Lord have mercy on his soul, said Aunt Kate compassionately. Amen, said Gabriel. So the old gentleman, as I said, harnessed Johnny and put on his very best tall hat and his very best stock collar and drove out in grand style from his ancestral mansion somewhere near Back Lane, I think. Everyone laughed, even Mrs. Mallins, at Gabriel's manner, and Aunt Kate said, oh now, Gabriel, he didn't live in Back Lane really, only the mill was there. Out from the mansion of his forefathers, continued Gabriel, he drove with Johnny. And everything went on beautifully until Johnny came in sight of King Billy's statue. And whether he fell in love with the horse King Billy sits on, or whether he thought he was back again in the mill, anyway, he began to walk round the statue. Gabriel paced in a circle round the hall in his galoshes amid the laughter of the others. Round and round he went, said Gabriel. And the old gentleman, who was a very pompous old gentleman, was highly indignant. Go on, sir. What do you mean, sir? Johnny, Johnny. Most extraordinary conduct. Can't understand the horse. The peals of laughter which followed Gabriel's imitation of the incident were interrupted by a resounding knock at the hall door. Mary Jane ran to open it and let in Freddie Malins. Freddie Malins, with his hat well back on his head and his shoulders humped with cold, was puffing and steaming after his exertions. I could only get one cab, he said. Oh, we'll find another along the quay, said Gabriel. Yes, said Aunt Kate. Better not keep Mrs. Malins standing in the draught.
Mrs. Malins was helped down the front steps by her son and Mr. Brown, and after many manoeuvres, hoisted into the cab. Freddie Malins clambered in after her and spent a long time settling her on the seat, Mr. Brown helping him with advice. At last she was settled comfortably, and Freddie Malins invited Mr. Brown into the cab. There was a good deal of confused talk, and then Mr. Brown got into the cab. The cabman settled his rug over his knees and bent down for the address. The confusion grew greater, and the cabman was directed differently by Freddie Malins and Mr. Brown, each of whom had his head out through the window of the cab. The difficulty was to know where to drop Mr. Brown along the route, and Aunt Kate, Aunt Julia and Mary Jane helped the discussion from the doorstep with cross directions and contradictions and abundance of laughter. As for Freddie Malins, he was speechless with laughter. He popped his head in and out of the window every moment to the great danger of his hat and told his mother how the discussion was progressing. Till at last Mr. Brown shouted to the bewildered cabman above the din of everybody's laughter. Do you know Trinity College? Yes, sir, said the cabman. Well, drive bang up against Trinity College gates, said Mr. Brown, and then we'll tell you where to go. You understand now? Yes, sir, said the cabman. Make like a board for Trinity College. Right, sir, cried the cabman. The horse was whipped up and the cab rattled off along the quay amid a chorus of laughter and adieus. Gabriel had not gone to the door with the others. He was in a dark part of the hall gazing up the staircase. A woman was standing near the top of the first flight, in the shadow also. He could not see her face, but he could see the terracotta and salmon pink panels of her skirt, which the shadow made appear black and white. It was his wife. She was leaning on the banisters, listening to something. Gabriel was surprised at her stillness and strained his ear to listen also. But he could hear little save the noise of laughter and dispute on the front steps, a few chords struck on the piano and a few notes of a man's voice singing. He stood still in the gloom of the hall, trying to catch the air that the voice was singing and gazing up at his wife. There was grace and mystery in her attitude, as if she were a symbol of something. He asked himself, what is a woman standing on the stairs in the shadow, listening to distant music, a symbol of? If he were a painter, he would paint her in that attitude. Her blue felt hat would show off the bronze of her hair against the darkness, and the dark panels of her skirt would show off the light ones. Distant music, he would call the picture, if he were a painter. The hall door was closed, and Aunt Kate, Aunt Julia, and Mary Jane came down the hall, still laughing. Well, isn't Freddie terrible, said Mary Jane. He's really terrible. Gabriel said nothing, but pointed up the stairs towards where his wife was standing. Now that the hall door was closed, the voice and the piano could be heard more clearly. Gabriel held up his hand for them to be silent. The song seemed to be in the old Irish tonality, and the singer seemed uncertain both of his words and of his voice. The voice, made plaintive by distance and by the singer's hoarseness, faintly illuminated the cadence of the air with words expressing grief. Oh, the rain falls on my heavy locks, and the dew wets my skin. My babe lies cold. Oh, exclaimed Mary Jane. It's Bartell D'Arcy singing, and he wouldn't sing all the night. Oh, I'll get him to sing a song before he goes. Oh, do, Mary Jane, said Aunt Kate. Mary Jane brushed past the others and ran up the staircase, but before she reached it, the singing stopped and the piano was closed abruptly. "Oh, what a pity," she cried. "Is he coming down, Greta?" Gabriel heard his wife answer, "Yes," and saw her coming down towards them. A few steps behind her were Mr. Bartell Darcy and Miss O'Callaghan. "Oh, Mr. Darcy," cried Mary Jane, "it's downright mean of you to break off like that when we were all in raptures listening to you." "I have been at him all the evening," said Miss O'Callaghan, "and Mrs. Conroy too, and he told us he had a dreadful cold and couldn't sing." "Oh, Mr. Darcy," said Aunt Kate, "now that was a great fib to tell."
"Can't you see that I'm as hoarse as a crow?" said Mr. Darcy roughly.
He went into the pantry hastily and put on his overcoat. The others, taken aback by his rude speech, could find nothing to say. Aunt Kate wrinkled her brows and made signs to the others to drop the subject. Mr. Darcy stood swathing his neck carefully and frowning. "It's the weather," said Aunt Julia after a pause. "Yes, everybody has colds," said Aunt Kate. "Everybody." "They say," said Mary Jane, "we haven't had snow like this for 30 years. And I read in the morning newspapers that the snow is in general all over Ireland." "I love the look of snow," said Aunt Julia sadly. "So do I," said Miss O'Callaghan. "I think Christmas is never really Christmas unless we have snow on the ground." "But poor Mr. Darcy doesn't like snow," said Aunt Kate, smiling. Mr. Darcy came from the pantry, fully swathed and buttoned, and in a repentant tone told them of the history of his cold. Everybody gave him advice, and then it was a great pity, and urged him to be very careful of the throat in the night air. Gabriel watched his wife, who did not join in the conversation. She was standing right under the dusty fanlight, and the flame of the gas lit upon the rich bronze of her hair, which he had seen her drying in the fire a few days before. She was in the same attitude and seemed unaware of the talk about her. At last she turned towards them, and Gabriel saw that there was colour on her cheeks and that her eyes were shining. A sudden tide of joy was leaping in his throat. "Mr. Darcy," she said, "what is the name of the song you were singing?" "It's called The Lass of Ockram," said Mr. Darcy, "but I couldn't remember it properly." "Why, do you know it?" "The Lass of Ockram," she repeated. "I couldn't think of the name." "It's a very nice air," said Mary Jane. "I'm sorry you were not in voice tonight." "Now, Mary Jane," said Aunt Kate, "don't annoy Mr. Darcy. I won't have him annoyed." Seeing that all were ready to start, she shepherded them to the door where the good night was said. "Well, good night, Aunt Kate, and thanks for a pleasant evening. Good night, Gabriel. Good night, Greta. Good night, Aunt Kate, and thanks ever so much. Good night, Aunt Julia." "Oh, good night, Greta. I didn't see you." "Good night, Mr. Darcy. Good night, Miss O'Callaghan. Good night, Miss Morgan. Good night again. Good night. Safe home. Good night. Good night."
The morning was still dark. A dull yellow light brooded over the houses and the river, and the sky seemed to be descending. It was slushy underfoot, and only streaks and patches of snow lay on the roofs, on the parapets of the quay, and on the area railings. The lamps were still burning redly in the murky air, and across the river, the palace of the forecourts stood out menacingly against the heavy sky. She was walking on before him with Mr. Bartell Darcy, her shoes in a brown parcel tucked under one arm, and her hands holding up her skirt from the slush. She had no longer any grace of attitude, but Gabriel's eyes were still bright with happiness. The blood went bounding along his veins, and the thoughts went rioting through his brain, proud, joyful, tender, valorous. She was walking on before him so lightly and so erect that he longed to run after her noiselessly, catch her by the shoulders, and say something foolish and affectionate into her ear. She seemed to him so frail that he longed to defend her against something and then to be alone with her. Moments of their secret life together burst like stars upon his memory. A heliotrope envelope was lying beside his breakfast cup, and he was caressing it with his hand. Birds were twittering in the ivy, and the sunny web of the curtain was shimmering along the floor. He could not eat for happiness. They were standing on the crowded platform, and he was placing a ticket inside the warm palm of her glove. He was standing with her in the cold, looking in through a grated window at a man making bottles in a roaring furnace. It was very cold. Her face, fragrant in the cold air, was quite close to his. And suddenly, she called out to the man at the furnace, "Is the fire hot, sir?" But the man could not hear her with the noise of the furnace. It was just as well. He might have answered rudely. A wave of yet more tender joy escaped from his heart and went coursing in warm flood along his arteries. Like the tender fires of stars, moments of their life together that no one knew or would ever know of, broken up and illumined his memory. He longed to recall to her those moments, to make her forget the years of their dull existence together and remember only their moments of ecstasy. For the years, he felt, had not quenched his soul or hers. Their children, his writing, her hair, household cares, had not quenched all their soul's tender fire. In one letter that he had written to her, then he had said, "Why is it that words like these seem to me so dull and cold? Is it because there is no word tender enough to be your name?"
Like distant music, these words that he had written years before were borne towards him from the past. He longed to be alone with her, and when the others had gone away, when he and she were in their room in the hotel, they would be alone together. He would call her softly, "Greta." Perhaps she would not hear it once she'd be undressing. Then something in his voice would strike her. She would turn and look at him. At the corner of Wine Tavern Street, they met a cab. He was glad of its rattling noise, as it saved him from conversation. She was looking out the window and seemed tired. The other spoke only a few words, pointing out some building or street. The horses galloped wearily along the murky morning sky, dragging his old rattling box after his heels. And Gabriel again was in a cab with her, galloping to catch the boat, galloping to their honeymoon. As the cab drove across O'Connell Bridge, Miss O'Callaghan said, "They say you should never cross O'Connell Bridge without seeing a white horse." "I see a white man this time," says Gabriel. "Where?" says Mr. Bartle Darcy. Gabriel pointed to the statue on which lay patches of snow, and then he nodded familiarly to it, waved his hand. "Good night, Dan," he said gaily. When the cab drew up past the hotel, Gabriel jumped out and, in spite of Mr. Bartle Darcy's protest, paid the cab. He gave the man a shilling over his fare. The man saluted him and said, "A prosperous new year to you, sir." The same to you, said Gabriel cordially. She leaned for a moment on his arm in getting out of the cab, and while standing on the curbstone, bidding the others good night, she leaned slightly on his arm, and as lightly as when she had danced with him a few hours before. He had felt proud and happy then. Happy that she was his, proud of her grace and wifely carriage. But now, after the kindling again of so many memories, the first touch of her body, musical and strange and perfumed, sent through him a keen pang of lust. Under the cover of her silence, he pressed her arm closely to his side, and when they stood at the hotel door, he felt they'd escaped from their lives and their duties, escaped from home and friends, and run away together with wild and radiant hearts to a new adventure.
An old man was dozing in a great hooded chair in the hall. He lit a candle in the office and went before them to the stairs. They followed him in silence, their feet falling in soft thuds on the thickly carpeted stairs. She mounted the stairs behind the porter, her head bowed in the ascent, her frail shoulders curved as with a burden. Her skirt gripped tightly about her. He could have flung his arms about her hips and held her still, for his arms were trembling with a desire to seize her, and only the stress of nails against the palms of his hands held the wild impulse of his body in check. The porter halted on the stairs to settle his guttering candle. They halted too on the steps below him. In the silence, Gabriel could hear the fall of the molten wax into the tray and the thumping of his own heart against his ribs. The porter led them along a corridor and opened a door. Then he set his unstable candle down on a toilet table and asked at what hour they were to be called in the morning. 8, said Gabriel. The porter pointed to the tap of the electric light and began a muttered apology, but Gabriel cut him short. We don't want any light. We have light enough from the street. And I say, he added, pointing to the candle, you might remove that handsome article like a good man. The porter took up his candle again, but slowly, for he was surprised by such a novel idea. Then he mumbled good night and went out. Gabriel shot the lock too. A ghostly light from the street lamp lay in a long shaft from one window to the door. Gabriel threw his overcoat and hat on a couch and crossed the room towards the window. He looked down into the street in order that his emotions might calm a little. Then he turned and leaned against a chest of drawers with his back to the light. She had taken off her hat and cloak and was standing before a large swinging mirror, unhooking her waist. Gabriel paused for a few moments, watching her, and then said, Greta. She turned away from the mirror slowly and walked along the shaft of light towards him. Her face looked so serious and weary that the words would not pass Gabriel's lips. No, it was not the moment yet. You look tired, he said. I am a little, she answered. You don't feel ill or weak? No, tired, that's all. She went onto the window and stood there, looking out. Gabriel waited again, and then, fearing that diffidence was about to conquer him, he said abruptly, By the way, Greta, what is it? You know that poor fellow Malins, he said quickly. Yes, what about him? Well, poor fellow, he's a decent sort of chap, after all, continued Gabriel in a false voice. He gave me back that sovereign I lent him, and I didn't expect it, really. It's a pity he wouldn't keep away from that Brown, because he's not a bad fellow at heart. He was trembling now with annoyance. Why did she seem so abstracted? He didn't know how he could begin. Was she annoyed, too, about something? If she would only turn to him, or come to him of her own accord. To take her as she would be brutal. No, he must see some ardour in her eyes first. He longed to be master of her strange mood. When did you lend him the pound? She asked after a pause. Gabriel strove to restrain himself from breaking out into brutal language about the sottish Malins and his pound. He longed to cry to her from his soul, to crush her body against his, to overmaster her. But he said, oh, at Christmas, when he opened that little Christmas card shop in Henry Street.
He was in such a fever of rage and desire that he did not hear her come from the window. She stood before him for an instant, looking at him strangely. Then suddenly raising herself on tiptoe and resting her hands lightly on his shoulders, she kissed him. You're a very generous person, Gabriel, she said. Gabriel, trembling with delight at her sudden kiss and at the quaintness of her phrase, put his hands on her hair and began smoothing it back scarcely touching it with his fingers. The washing had made it fine and brilliant. His heart was brimming over with happiness. Just when he was wishing for it, she had come to him on her own accord. Perhaps her thoughts had been running with his. Perhaps she'd felt the impetuous desire that was in him. And then the yielding mood had come upon her. Now she had fallen to him so easily, he wondered why he had been so diffident. He stood holding her head between his hands, then slipping one arm swiftly about her body and drawing her towards him, he said softly, "Greta, dear, what are you thinking about?" She did not answer nor yield wholly to his arm. He said again softly, "Tell me, what is it, Greta? I think I know what is the matter. Do I know?" She did not answer at once. Then she said, in an outburst of tears, "Oh, I'm thinking about that song, The Lass of Ockram." She broke loose from him and ran to the bed, and throwing her arms across the bed rail, hid her face. Gabriel stood stock still for a moment in astonishment, and then followed her. As he passed in the way of the cheval glass, he caught sight of himself in full length. His broad, well-filled shirt front, the face whose expression always puzzled him when he saw it in a mirror, and his glimmering, gilt-rimmed eyeglasses. He halted a few paces from her and said, "What about the song? Why does that make you cry?" She raised her head from her arms and dried her eyes with the back of her hand like a child. A kinder note than he had intended went into his voice. "Why, Greta?" he asked. "I'm thinking about a person long ago who used to sing that song." "And who was that person long ago?" asked Gabriel, smiling. "It was a person I used to know in Galway when I was living with my grandmother," she said. The smile passed away from Gabriel's face. A dull anger began to gather again at the back of his mind, and the dull fires of his lust began to glow angrily in his veins. "Someone you were in love with?" he asked ironically. "It was a young boy I used to know," she answered, "named Michael Fury. He used to sing that song, The Lass of Ockram. He was very delicate." Gabriel was silent. He did not wish her to think that he was interested in this delicate boy. "I can see him so plainly," she said after a moment. "Such eyes as he had, big, dark eyes, and such an expression in them. An expression." "Oh, then you were in love with him," said Gabriel. "I used to go out walking with him," she said, "when I was in Galway." A thought flew across Gabriel's mind. "Perhaps that's why you wanted to go to Galway with the Ivers girl," he said coldly. She looked at him and asked in surprise, "What for?" Her eyes made Gabriel feel awkward. He shrugged his shoulders and said, "How do I know? To see him, perhaps." She looked away from him along the shaft of light towards the window in silence. "He's dead," she said at length. "He died when he was only 17. Isn't it a terrible thing to die so young as that?" "What was he?" asked Gabriel, still ironically. "He was in the gasworks," she said.
Gabriel felt humiliated by the failure of his irony and by the evocation of this figure from the dead, a boy in the gasworks. While he had been full of memories of their secret life together, full of tenderness and joy and desire, she had been comparing him in her mind with another. A shameful consciousness of his own person assailed him. He saw himself as a ludicrous figure, acting as a penny boy for his aunts, a nervous, well-meaning sentimentalist, orating to vulgarians and idealizing his own clownish lusts, the pitiable, fatuous fellow he had caught a glimpse of in the mirror. Instinctively, he turned his back to the light lest she might see the shame that burned upon his forehead. He tried to keep up his tone of cold interrogation, but his voice, when he spoke, was humble and indifferent. "I suppose you were in love with this Michael Fury, Greta," he said. "I was great with him at the time," she said. Her voice was veiled and sad, Gabriel feeling now how vain it would be to try to lead her whither he had proposed, caressed one of her hands and said, also sadly, "And what did he die of so young, Greta? Consumption, was it?" "I think he died for me," she answered. A vague terror seized Gabriel at this answer, as if at that hour when he had hoped to triumph, some impalpable and vindictive being was coming against him, gathering forces against him in its vague world. But he shook himself free of it with an effort of reason and continued to caress her hand. He did not question her again, for he felt she would tell him of herself. Her hand was warm and moist. It did not respond to his touch, but he continued to caress it, just as he caressed her first letter to him that spring morning. "It was in the winter," she said, "about the beginning of the winter, when I was going to leave my grandmother's and come up here to the convent. And he was ill at the time in his lodgings in Galway and wouldn't be let out. And his people in Uachtarard were written to. He was in decline, they said, or something like that. I never knew rightly." She paused for a moment and sighed. "Poor fellow," she said. "He was very fond of me, and he was such a gentle boy. We used to go out together, walking, you know. You know, Gabriel, like the way they do in the country. He was going to study singing, only for his health. He had a very good voice, poor Michael Fury." "Well, and then?" asked Gabriel. "And then when it came to the time for me to leave Galway and come up to the convent, he was much worse. And I wouldn't be let him see him, so I wrote him a letter, saying I was going up to Dublin and would be back in the summer and hoping he would be better then." She paused for a moment to get her voice under control and then went on. "Then the night before I left, I was in my grandmother's house in Nuns Island packing up, and I heard gravel thrown up against the window. The window was so wet, I couldn't see, so I ran downstairs as I was and slipped out the back into the garden. And there was the poor fellow at the end of the garden, shivering. 'And did you not tell him to go back?' asked Gabriel. 'I implored of him to go home at once and told him he'd get his death in the rain. But he said he did not want to live. I can see his eyes as well as well. He was standing at the end of the wall where there was a tree.' 'And did he go home?' asked Gabriel. 'Yes, he went home. And when I was only a week in the convent, he died, and he was buried in Uachtarard, where his people came from. Oh, the day I heard that he was dead.'" She stopped, choking with sobs and overcome by emotion, flung herself face downwards on the bed, sobbing in the quilt. Gabriel held her hand for a moment longer, irresolutely, and then, shy of intruding on her grief, let it fall gently and walked quietly to the window.
She was fast asleep. Gabriel, leaning on his elbow, looked for a few moments unresentfully on her tangled hair and a half-open mouth, listening to her deep-drawn breath. So she had had that romance in her life. A man had died for her sake. It hardly pained him now to think how poor a part he, her husband, had played in her life. He watched her while she slept, as though he and she had never lived together as man and wife. His curious eyes rested long upon her face and on her hair, and as he thought of what she must have been then, in that time of her forced girlish beauty, a strange friendly pity for her entered his soul. He did not like to say, even to himself, that her face was no longer beautiful, but he knew that it was no longer the face for which Michael Fury had braved death. Perhaps she had not told him all the story. His eyes moved to the chair over which she had thrown some of her clothes. A petticoat string dangled on the floor. One boot stood upright, its limp upper fallen below. The fellow of it lay upon its side. He wondered at his riot of emotions of an hour before. From what had it proceeded? From his aunt's supper, from his own foolish speech, from the wine and dancing, the merrymaking when saying good night in the hall, the pleasure of the walk along the river in the snow. Poor Aunt Julie, she too would soon be a shade with the shade of Patrick Morgan and his horse. He had caught that haggard look upon her face for a moment when she was singing arrayed for the bridal. Soon, perhaps, he would be sitting in that same drawing room, dressed in black, his silk hat on his knees. The blinds would be drawn down, and Aunt Kate would be sitting beside him, crying and blowing her nose, and telling him how Julia had died. He would cast about in his mind for some words that might console her, and would find only lame and useless ones. Yes, yes, that would happen very soon. The air of the room chilled his shoulders. He stretched himself cautiously along the sheets and lay down beside his wife. One by one, they were all becoming shades. Better pass boldly into the other world, in the full glory of some passion, than fade and wither dismally with age. He thought of how she who lay beside him had locked in her heart for so many years that image of her lover's eyes, when he had told her that he did not wish to live. Generous tears filled Gabriel's eyes. He had never felt like that himself towards any woman, but he knew that such a feeling must be love. The tears gathered more thickly in his eyes, and in the partial darkness, he imagined he saw the form of a young man standing under a dripping tree. Other forms were near. His soul had approached that region where dwelled the vast hosts of the dead. He was conscious of, but could not apprehend, their wayward and flickering existence. His own identity was fading out into a grey, impalpable world, the solid world itself which these dead had one time reared and lived in was dissolving and dwindling. A few light taps upon the pane made him turn to the window. It had begun to snow again. He watched sleepily the flakes, silver and dark, falling obliquely against the lamplight. The time had come for him to set out on his journey westward. Yes, the newspapers were right. Snow was general all over Ireland. It was falling on every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hills, falling softly upon the Bonnacavallen and far westward, softly falling into the dark, mutinous Shannon waves. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard on the hill where Michael Fury lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little gate, on the barren thorns. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe and faintly falling like the descent of their last end upon all the living and the dead.
My name is Peter Pryor, and I'm also a member of the Near FM drama group. And I have been interested in James Joyce and his work for a while. I've been in a few productions of James. I've actually been in a production of The Dead. We did it in the James Joyce Centre in North Georgia Street about 7 or 8 years ago. I've also been in a production where we did a rehearsed reading of the Sirens chapter of Ulysses as well in the Teachers Club. I'm also a member of the Dublin Shakespeare Society, and I'm very interested in James Joyce and in his work. I have to say I don't understand everything or quite a lot of what he writes, but it does get through to me in a certain sort of way. I think probably what you're doing today, like, is one of the best ways to kind of get an understanding of Joyce. I think his work has to be read out loud because it's as much about the sound of words as the sense of words. And when you just let yourself sort of be brought into that, to the sound of his writing, like, you really, really get a different appreciation of what he's about.
Hello, my name is Rebecca Blomfield, and I'm here today because Debbie asked me to come along, and I've always been fascinated by James Joyce. I've tried to read Ulysses and didn't have that much success with it, but I've dabbled in the Dubliners a bit, and the story that I really like, particularly this time of year, is The Dead. that James Joyce wrote, because there's an epiphany and a Christmas feel to it.
Well, my name is Joe Murphy, part of the Near FM drama group, and I saw this little advertisement here about reading James Joyce and stuff, so I was interested, so I said I'd come down and give it a try.
Yeah, I'm Michael Sharp again, like Peter and Joe. I'm a member of Near FM drama group, and we were asked, were we interested in coming along to read Dubliners or the other activities? And I expressed an interest because I've always been interested in Joyce and particularly in Dubliners, so that's how I came to be here.
My name is Mary, and I'm a Dubliner, although I live in London. And we both love Joyce, and we just love the Montclair and the area. And my friend grew up in this area, and we went to school. It's my area where I live. As a child, I came to.
We are outgrowing James Joyce, I think. That's my opinion. But then again, everybody else has their opinion of. They think it may be relevant, but I don't. I don't, not anymore.
Hi, my name is Mary McNamara, and I'm a member of the Near Drama Group. And basically what brought me here today is I do love Joyce and a lot of his readings, and so this opportunity to have a chance to read from it live and all that in front of an audience myself was wonderful, because I may not get the chance to do it in the Abbey, so this was the next best thing, so I was delighted to be asked and involved in it.
I think a lot of people are not aware, I think a lot of writers are influenced by Joyce. I'm not a writer, but a lot of people, when they're asked, they say they're very much influenced by Joyce, and people who are listening to different writers, to people who write novels, people who write drama, people who write poetry, they're being influenced by Joyce, because the writers of those have been influenced by Joyce. So I think he's very, very, very relevant, and I think he's a kind of a touchstone for a lot of people, a lot of Irish people, not just Irish people, people all over the world. Like, I mean, he's still regarded as a colossal writer.
I think it's, I would disagree with Joe. I think it's quite relevant. It's perhaps a little unfortunate that a lot of it is quite abstruse and not easy to read. I mean, I know I've started Finnegan's Wake about half a dozen times and never got beyond the first few pages. And even Ulysses, although it's easier to read, but there's so many, you have to really get all the classical allusions and things like that. But some of his other writings, and Dubliners in particular, I mean, is I think magnificent. Each of the stories stands up its own right, but then as a collection, they're superb. So I think it's something that Irish people should read, or should try to get into Joyce. And obviously he's very famous internationally, perhaps more so than in Ireland.
I think it's still very, very relevant. I mean, the way he writes, the way the ebbs and flows of his writing, it's fascinating. But also things like In the Dead, there was one gentleman being called a West Brit. Me speaking slightly with an English accent and being a Dubliner, I can sympathise with him, and also the nationalist feeling in it, and also the Christmas party. You know, our society is very much, maybe we've lost it a little bit, but I think now with the recession, we're going back more to having family get-togethers and Christmas parties at home, rather than flamboyant parties out in posh restaurants.
Very relevant, actually, because I think that they reflected Dublin that is still there underneath all the... And I think especially now in the economic downturn, they're getting people to look again at maybe different kind of values and question. And I think people are just enjoying and using Joyce too in a strange way to come together. Joyce hasn't been so just for the academic or the intellectual, it's for everybody. I feel people recognise characters in it and maybe seeing their neighbours or themselves. So I feel that this is really very relevant. And becomes, and it's a lifetime occupation, Joyce, more and more, the more you read, the more you want to read, yes.
Dubliners have a certain wit. They're very quick-witted, and I know people say they can be cutting, but a Dubliner always can come back with a quick answer or a quick-witted. And I think that goes back generations. Like, I know they used to say to put people down would be a... But it's not a putting down, it's just a quick wit. There's no harm meant in it. And to me, that would be a true Dubliner now. That, hell yeah, that's a country fella wouldn't do it now, but a Dubliner now. How would you get out of there now with your notions of operosity? If you've got something nice now, a Dubliner would be looking at you. Where do you think you're going with that now, love? Jesus, it's far from that you were reared. That's the sort of Dubliner wit, I think. So that would be my idea of a Dubliner.
Well... You may be able to ascertain from my accent, I'm not a Dubliner. I come from the west of Ireland, but I've lived in Dublin quite a long time. And to me, it's done up. But to me, what defined a Dubliner, a true Dubliner, was a sense of humour, good sense of humour, and the ability to put people down very quickly, to put you in your place very quickly if you stepped out of line. But doing it in a very nice way, but in a way that you knew, in a very funny sort of way. I think Dublin people had that, just the ability just to very quickly off the mark, you know, put you down. But in a way that you didn't feel offended by, but also you appreciate it was very witty as well. That to me is kind of the true hallmark. There's a certain sort of wit, I think, that defines Dublin people. It's not as common as it used to be, and it's harder to find. It's, you know, it's probably the same value isn't being put on it, but that to me is what defines a true Dublin.
I don't think you would initially have to be born and bred a Dubliner, but just living here and things like I came in on the Dart today and just being able to appreciate the landmarks in Dublin, little Irishisms that you might see on the Dart, people talking, little expressions that you wouldn't get in another English-speaking country. And an appreciation of the arts in Dublin and in Ireland. But I suppose being a Dubliner in Dublin. And things like, you know, the Dublin pubs and the history that we have. And I think as well we've become more, how do you say, people are getting more close again. Like we were maybe in the 80s. Everyone knows each other or everyone knows someone who knows somebody. You know what I mean? For instance, if there's a death or a birth or a marriage, somebody that you might know would know those people. And I find you wouldn't get that in London or Paris.
Well, originally it was a camaraderie, neighbours, really mainly neighbours, people getting on with each other. If people had no money, other people would help them out. Now it's they just walk all over them. It's changed completely since James Joyce's time. I think a Dublin person now is an individual, whereas years ago Dublin people were a group of people, everybody hung in together, everybody helped each other out. Now it's just every man for himself. Sorry to say, but that's the way it's going.
I'm not born in Dublin. I often say to people my father was unique. He migrated from London to the west of Ireland in the 1950s, but I've lived in Dublin most of my life, and I think he does capture a Dublin that existed certainly at the turn of the century when he was writing and in the early years of the century, but many of the characters are still there. I mean, you can still see the people that, if you read his stories, you can still see people who display many of the characters that, many of the characteristics that he's writing about. So, as a Dubliner, I think you still see Joyce characters around the place.
Well, maybe you could say being born a Dubliner, but then Michael McLemore wasn't born a Dubliner, and I think he would consider himself, I think in a way, a sense of values. I think the Dubliners are very kind. They're not actually cunning, and in a way, they're not conniving. They're very much more open, perhaps, than...
A sense of humour,
definitely sense of humour. And the quirkiness. And also, I think that they have humour, like in dark situations, they have, wouldn't you say, they have in dark situations, they'll always have a turn.
Casey,
like O'Casey's Dubliners and Singh and all of those. I think it's been very special being a Dubliner, actually.
And with that, we finished with the dead. The story was recorded in the Montclair Hotel, and we were joined by some of the members of the Sweeney Pharmacy Group. Among our readers were Rebecca Bloomfield, Declan Cahill, Colin Keating, Peter Pryor, Joe Murphy, Mary McNamara, and Michael Sharp. For two of our readings, Clay and Evelyn, we travel to Raheny Public Library. Thanks, Terry. And next is Evelyn, read to us by Sheila McGettrick, Paula Skellen and David
Eyre. She sat at the window watching the evening invade the avenue. Her head was leaned against the window curtains and in her nostrils was the odour of dusty cretonne. She was tired. Few people passed. The man out of the last house passed on his way home. She heard his footsteps clacking along the concrete pavement and afterwards crunching in the cinder path before the new red houses. One time there used to be a field there in which they used to play every evening with other people's children. Then a man from Belfast bought the field and built houses in it. Not like their little brown houses, but bright brick houses with shining roofs. The children of the avenue used to play together in that field. The Devines, the Waters, the Duns, little Cure the Cripple, she and her brothers and sisters. Ernest, however, never played. He was too grown up. Her father used often to hunt them in out of the field with his blackthorn stick. But usually little Cure used to keep nicks and call out when he saw her father coming. Still, they seemed to have been rather happy then. Her father was not so bad then. And besides, her mother was alive. That was a long time ago. She and her brothers and sisters were all grown up. Her mother was dead. Tizzy Dunn was dead too. And the Waters had gone back to England. Everything changes. Now she was going away like the others, to leave her home. Home. She looked round the room, reviewing all its familiar objects, which she had dusted once a week for so many years, wondering where on earth all that dust came from. Perhaps she would never see again those familiar objects from which she had never dreamed of being divided. And yet during all those years, she had never found out the name of the priest whose yellowing photograph hung on the wall above the broken harmonium beside the coloured print of promises made to Blessed Mary Margaret Alacoque. He had been a school friend of her father. Whenever he showed the photograph to a visitor, her father used to pass it with a casual word. He is in Melbourne now. She had consented to go away, to leave her home. Was that wise? She tried to weigh each side of the question. In her home anyway, she had shelter and food. She had those whom she had known all her life about her. Of course, she had to work hard, both in the house and at business. What would they say of her in the stores when they found out that she had run away with a fellow? Say she was a fool, perhaps, and her place would be filled by advertisement. Miss Gavin would be glad. She had always an edge on her, especially when there were people listening. Miss Hill, don't you see these ladies are waiting? Look lively, Miss Hill, please. She would not cry many tears at leaving the stores.
But in her new home, in a distant, unknown country, it would not be like that. Then she would be married, she, Evelyn. People would treat her with respect then. She would not be treated as her mother had been. Even now, though she was over 19, she sometimes felt herself in danger of her father's violence. She knew it was that had given her the palpitations. When they were growing up, he had never gone for her like he used to go for Harry and Ernest, because she was a girl. But latterly he had begun to threaten her and say what he would do to her only for her dead mother's sake. And now she had nobody to protect her. Ernest was dead, and Harry, who was in the church decorating business, was nearly always down somewhere in the country. Besides, the invariable squabble for money on Saturday nights had begun to weary her unspeakably. She always gave her entire wages, 7 shillings, and Harry always sent up what he could, but the trouble was to get any money from her father. He said she used to squander the money, that she had no head, and that he wasn't going to give her his hard-earned money to throw about the streets, and much more, for he was usually fairly bad of a Saturday night. In the end, he would give her the money and ask her, had she any intention of buying Sunday's dinner? Then she had to rush out as quickly as she could and do her marketing, holding her black leather purse tightly in her hand as she elbowed her way through the crowds and returning home late under her load of provisions. She had hard work to keep the house together and to see that the 2 young children who had been left to her charge went to school regularly and got their meals regularly. It was hard work, a hard life, and now that she was about to leave, she did not find it a wholly undesirable life. She was about to explore another life with Frank. Frank was very kind, manly, open-hearted. She was to go away with him by the night boat to be his wife, and to live with him in Buenos Aires, where he had a home waiting for her. How well she remembered the first time she'd seen him. He was lodging in the house on the main road where she used to visit. It seemed a few weeks ago. He was standing at the gate, his peaked cap pushed back on his head and his hair tumbled forward over a face of bronze. Then they had come to know each other. He used to meet her outside the stores every evening and see her home. He took her to see The Bohemian Girl, and she felt elated as she sat in an unaccustomed part of the theatre with him. He was awfully fond of music and sang a little. People knew that they were courting. And when he sang about the lass that loves a sailor, she always felt pleasantly confused. He used to call her Poppins out of fun. First of all, it had been an excitement for her to have a fella. And then she had to begin to like him. He had tales of distant countries. He had started as a deck boy at £1 a month on a ship of the Allan Line going out to Canada. He told her the names of the ships he had been on and the names of the different services. He had sailed through the Straits of Magellan, and he told her stories of the terrible Patagonians. He had fallen on his feet in Buenos Aires, he said, and had come over to the old country just for a holiday. Of course, her father had found out the affair and had forbidden her to have anything to say to him. I know these sailor chaps, he said.
One day, he had quarrelled with Frank, and after that she had to meet her lover secretly. The evening deepened in the avenue. The white of two letters in her lap grew indistinct. One was to Harry, the other was to her father. Ernest had been her favourite, but she liked Harry too. Her father was becoming old lately, she noticed. He would miss her. Sometimes he could be very nice. Not long before, when she had been laid up for a day, he had read her out a ghost story and made toast for her by the fire. Another day, when her mother was alive, they had all gone for a picnic to the Hill of Howth. She remembered her father putting on her mother's bonnet to make the children laugh. Her time was running out, but she continued to sit by the window, leaning her head against the window curtain, inhaling the odour of dusty cretonne. Down far in the avenue, she could hear a street organ playing. She knew the air. Strange that it should come that very night to remind her of the promise to her mother, her promise to keep the home together as long as she could. She remembered the last night of her mother's illness. She was again in the closed dark room at the other side of the hall, and outside she heard a melancholy air of Italy. The organ player had been ordered to go away and given sixpence. She remembered her father strutting back into the sick room saying, "Damned Italians coming over here." As she mused, the pitiful vision of her mother's life laid its spell on the very quick of her being. That life of commonplace sacrifices closing in final craziness. She trembled as she heard again her mother's voice saying constantly with foolish insistence, "Deravon Seron, Deravon Seron." She stood up in a sudden impulse of terror. Escape! She must escape. Frank would save her. He would give her life, perhaps love too. But she wanted to live. Why should she be unhappy? She had a right to happiness. Frank would take her in his arms, fold her in his arms. He would save her. She stood among the swaying crowd in the station at the North Wall. He held her hand and she knew that he was speaking to her, saying something about the passage over and over again. The station was full of soldiers with brown baggages. Through the wide doors of the sheds, she caught a glimpse of the black mass of the boat, lying in beside the quay wall, with illumined portholes. She answered nothing. She felt her cheek pale and cold, and out of a maze of distress, she prayed to God to direct her, to show her what was her duty. The boat blew a long, mournful whistle into the mist. If she went tomorrow, she would be on sea with Frank, steaming towards Buenos Aires. Their passage had been booked. Could she still draw back after all he had done for her? Her distress awoke a nausea in her body, and she kept moving her lips in silent, fervent prayer. A bell clanged upon her heart. She felt him seize her hand. Come! All the seas of the world tumbled about her heart. He was drawing her into them. he would drown her. She gripped with both hands at the iron railing. Come. No, no, no. It was impossible. Her hands clutched the iron in frenzy. Amid the seas, she sent a cry of anguish. Evelyn! Evie! He rushed beyond the barrier and called to her to follow. He was shouted at to go on, but he still called to her. She set her white face to him, passive, like a helpless animal. Her eyes gave him no sign of love or farewell or recognition.
And that's all for this week. Next week we go to Darndale Youth Project, Sphere 17, where the youth involved in the project read from Araby and the Encounter.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.